Time is 1:50 approximately. Members present, Senator Torsen, Senator Lehman, Senator Davis, Senator Osterman, myself, Senator Stevens. Today we have on the agenda House Bill 470, Common Interest Ownership, House Bill 360, Euthanasia for Domestic Animals, and House Bill 389, Municipal Tax Exemption for Deteriorated Property. And we'll start with House Bill 470, and Representative Roekberg is here. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, member of the committee. My name is Representative Norman Roekberg from District 11 in West Anchorage. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for taking up this legislation. Mr. Chairman, there was an anomaly in our Common Ownership Act that was brought to my attention by a constituent of Senator Torgerson's. That being that when during the construction of condominium-type developments, it's necessary under our statute to provide a public offering statement which requires certain specific information, including such things as a legal description and other technical matters, which, in fact, Mr. Chairman, cannot be fully completed until the unit itself is completed, and what the circumstances were in the Land's End area of Homer were that high-end condominiums were being built on a custom-built basis in the cost range of, let's say, $500,000 to $750,000. But because of the peculiarity of our statute, the delivery of the public offering statement couldn't occur until after the units were complete, and at that time, under our statute, the buyer had the opportunity to back out of the deal. And on top of that, Mr. Chairman, he had an opportunity to collect 10% of the value of the transaction. So, in other words, somebody could bargain for a very costly unit, back out of the deal, break his privity of contract, and thus be rewarded by our statute to the tune of $75,000. What this bill does, Mr. Chairman, is fix that little anomaly by providing that a preliminary public offering statement be provided, which is very similar in nature to the final product, and also indicates if there is a any award to be made by the courts that it could be up to 10%, not specifically 10%. Therefore, giving the judge the ability to look at the circumstances and the facts of the case. Mr. Chairman, that basically reflects the heart of this matter. There are a few people on to testify, so if you like, Mr. Chairman, I will answer any questions you may have and allow the public testimony and then perhaps answer some more.
Thank you. Senator Lehman?
Representative Roekberg, this is a revision to the Uniform Common Interest Ownership Act. Now, this is one of these uniform acts that we've adopted that's common across the United States?
As a matter of fact, I've been working with the home builders for about 3 years on a revision to it, which is some 40 or 50 pages long.
So it's likely that other states would have the same anomaly, unless they've gone in and actually revised the Uniform Act.
Well, usually this doesn't come out, and it hasn't come to light after the many years, because mostly when townhouse, condominium, or PUD-type developments are put together and marketed, they're not as high-ended. So, and there's not as much risk on the part of a developer to go ahead and say if the transaction doesn't close, and then being sold to somebody else. But this becomes very glaring when you have a high-end resort-type condominium situation like they do at the Land's End and Homer Spit, which the letter in the packet comes from Mr. Jonathan Faulkner and details that particular plight that he's in. In addition, Mr. Chairman, I'd say, and Senator Lehman, the financing problems that revolve around that because of this peculiarity, particularly now because we're aware of it, if you will, I think it's important that, which can be resolved by this bill.
Senator Osterman?
I'm not very familiar with the Uniform Common Interest Ownership Act. So can you explain just a little bit the difference between what that does and the original, and a typical homeowner goes out and custom builds a house or has a custom built house.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Senator Osterman, forgive me. He's the original Terminator, I get it. In this state, the first statutory enactment we had was the Horizontal Regime Act. That allowed for the sales, marketing, and the legal conveyance of a condominium or townhouse. That was superseded, 18 years ago, I believe, by the UCI, or the Uniform Common Ownership Act. So actually we have in the state certain, some projects built under the Horizontal Regime Act and all the newer ones under the Common Ownership Act. But what that does, it sets up a form of ownership which is not in fee simple. It sets up a different estate in land where you can convey fundamentally airspace. For example, a condominium could be in a high-rise building, and the conveyance of title is only to that box, if you will, within that particular building. So that premise as legally defined is conveyed in fee simple. But there's other forms too. For example, I live in a townhouse project which is underneath the Ukiah. That is where there's a grant of actual fee simple title into the land around it and the building itself, which has a party wall. But then the common areas of the balance of the project are held in the common interest of the balance of the owners of the project. So you can have different forms or permutations of the way the projects are put together. And but just thinking of the condominium form of ownership, and airspace probably best defines it.
Senator Osterman?
Being that it's common ownership, creates a different set of rules than just their yes. single unit home that they're about to be built. And the single unit home is a contract based upon building that house. I mean, it's a finite deal to start with. Is that what you're saying? Whereas interest units would not be a finite.
You could have standalone property in fee simple and the ownership of the improvement in fee, but have no common ownership. But I would also say, through the chair, Senator Osterman, that right. It's not uncommon now, however, for even detached single-family homes to have homeowners associations and so forth that may own some land in common and therefore trigger some provisions, I think, of Ukiah. There are some folks in the home builders that are much more familiar with Ukiah and its problems. For example, there's percentages of ownership, there's annual meetings that must be undertaken. Matter of fact, I've had to rewrite the real estate law to take into account the accounting of the monies for these common ownership groups. You might recall that a few years back. And even establish a new license. There's a license now in the state of Alaska where you have a real estate endorsement for common for a community association management. So it's the community associations that are the hallmark of the Ukiah.
In your statement, you talked about the high-end aspects of it creating the problem that these high-end units are being built and then some people are backing out. These are business decisions, no different than the lower-end units that are being built. But it's a business decision to build these higher-end units. I assume hoping the profitability will be higher. But in essence, what we're doing here, if I read this in very simplistic terms, is we're protecting them from themselves in building these high-end units, protecting them so that they can go ahead and build them without having somebody back out on the deal.
To the chair, Representative Osterman, I think what we're doing is facilitating commerce here. What we have is a circumstance where it's an entirely unilateral right of the consumer, if you will, here, or the buyer, let's not call him the general consumer, would have the right to back out, and not only just back out of their contractual obligations, by statute, that they have, they even have the ability to profit here. It's kind of an unusual circumstance. Because, as Senator Lehman's pointed out, we've adopted a national uniform law with this provision in it. There are two representatives of the home builders online that might be able to give you some more practical examples of how this occurs in the real world. And I understand Mr. Faulkner is also online, too.
Any further questions from the committee? With that, I think we do have some people online. Go to the Anchorage LIO, Robin Ward.
Yes, sir.
Hey, please state your affiliation, Ms. Ward, and go ahead with your testimony.
Yes, I'm Robin Ward. I'm the co-chair of legislative affairs for the Alaska State Home Builders, and I am a professional association manager for common interest properties. The Anchorage, or the Alaska State Home Builders, does support this bill. We have been working with Representative Brokberg for the past few years. This was uniform legislation that was passed, I believe, in 1984, and there was a model amendment of uniform of this act that was also enacted in 1994. So we took the model legislation plus some amendments that needed to be taken care of in the state of Alaska and have been working on those. But these are two issues that have really plagued us this year especially. It felt like we needed to fast track these. So we pulled these two out of the large bill to work on these. And part of the problem is that the risk is higher in the higher end units, but the risk is the same for all developers. When they have, they can get to the closing table and someone can back out. It really does hurt on the financing side of it. But again, I'll let Mr. Faulkner talk a little bit about that. But I do want to let you know that one of the reasons that this is happening this year is that we are building a lot more of them. Right now, in the market in Anchorage, half of the listings are new construction, and almost half of those fall under the Community Uniform Common Interest Ownership Act in one form or another. Even today in our subdivisions, if there is a small piece of land where a sign sits on, a streetlight area, any kind of a greenbelt, it triggers this law. You have to have a homeowners association provide public offering and so on. And in Anchorage, most of the developers are fairly well versed in this law, but one of the things that we're finding out is in outlying areas like the Matsu Valley, parts of Fairbanks and Juneau, have never really built very much common interest property before, and they're not aware of this law. In fact, many of the attorneys today are not aware of this law, and they're not even notifying the developers when they're setting up, you know, house rules and CC&Rs in their subdivision that they fall under this act and have to provide the public offering statement. That's why we felt it was important to change that penalty from a prescribed penalty to leave it up to the court to be able to assess the penalty based on the merits of the violation. So with that, I'll go ahead and open it up to any questions.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? With no questions, thank you for your testimony. Next, we'll go to Jess Hall. Are you there?
Yes, sir.
Please state your affiliation, Mr. Hall, and go ahead with your testimony.
Yes, thank you. Jess Hall. I'm a builder in the Matsu Valley. I just wanted to kind of touch base. Ms. Ward kind of talked about some of the things that run into in terms of the Ukiah Act. I've done a development out here, and there's a few others that are starting to do developments. And what we found is, and you know, with my past history in building, I've done some condominiums back in the mid-80s that actually fell under the Horizontal Property Regimes Act. Since then, we went through the oil crash, and there hasn't been too much of that kind of building going on. When I did my development, I knew if I had done a condominium, I would need to involve an attorney and put together a pretty fair amount of paperwork to cover all the common walls and roofs and so on. However, we did a subdivision with the homeowner association, with the covenants, all the CC&Rs, with the water system into the subdivision, set all the covenants up with all the information necessary to show that they were going to have just didn't happen to be in exactly the right form of math to be called public offering statement. So what we found out is that when we got through part of it was we needed to regress and start over and do a public offering statement. Well, as you read through the act, you'll see that the 10% penalty part is kind of interesting because if you don't hand out a public offering statement, you're liable for 10% of the sale price of the property. So in a condominium, that's kind of interesting. However, this development is all single family, fee simple stuff. And there are no common elements in terms of the houses that can be built or just the lot sales. But remotely, you have a water system over there. Being as how it's common, it does fall under this act. And as Robin Ward mentioned, also, that can get as tiny as a 10 by 10 piece of land with a subdivision sign on it that you would have to pay property taxes on. And there are cases where, at least in the valley, some of the subdivisions have that. They have a homeowner association which was formed just to enforce the covenants and those kinds of things, but they also own this whole piece of property, has their sign on it, which probably has 50 cents a month worth of property taxes due by each homeowner. Well, a public offering statement wasn't given to each one of those homeowners, they're liable for 10% of the sales price of their house. Pretty hefty fee. So it would make sense to at least go to a point where, the judge could state what the real, cost or negligence or whatever on the part of the developer to do that. I think we probably need a lot more revisions. As Representative Rokeberg mentioned, we'll probably need to go through this and kind of refine that a little bit. I think in condominiums, it makes a lot of sense. They need a lot of information, but some of these other situations are so much more simple. A lot of paperwork and attorney's fees and just plain a load to put on the developer for something that really doesn't have too much interest in it. So with that, I appreciate your time, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions or comments from the committee? Thank you, Mr. Hall. Next, we'll go to Chuck Spinelli.
Hi, this is Chuck Spinelli. I'm with the Anchorage Home Builders in Anchorage. I'd like to just testify regarding the 10% penalty, basically, and just kind of relate an example. I've been building out in the Eagle River and Eagle Crossing subdivision for the last 15 years, and although the type and the look of the whole subdivision hasn't changed much, the law has. And at one time, when we were first building out there, it was called Parkview Terrace, and we were building as a de minimis PUD. And basically, we didn't have to worry about public offering statements. There was some land held in common, green belts and so forth, and the people were paying about $15 a month, $20 a month, depending on which area they were in the subdivision, and they would get, this public offering statement, which was sort of minimal, and everybody went on their merry way. When the Ukiah law came through, we were inundated with regulations and expense, and the new sections of Eagle Crossing cost about $5,000 to $7,000 to create this monster, 2-inch thick volume of work they call the public offering statement. And then for every one that you hand out to a buyer, it costs another $175 or so to give them a copy of this thing. And what it amounts to is that it basically describes, the CC&Rs of the subdivision and so forth. And at the very end, it tells them the amount of dues they should expect, or cost. And in Eagle Crossing, those dues are generally less than $15 a month. And in most of the sections, we have reserved development rights and have never collected any dues to date. But in the event we do start collecting dues, they'd be $180 or so a month.
$180 times, I think, 1,000% is $18,000. So, you know, that's the kind of penalty we would be getting if we forgot, for some reason, forgot to give somebody one of these public offering statements. And what is so peculiar in the statute is it just basically states that if you don't provide this public offering statement, that the penalty is 10% of the sales price of the house. It doesn't tell you how they get it, or they just, you know, send you a bill and you have to pay it, or they got to go to court or whatever. But it's been sort of an oddity, you know, that I have been concerned about for a long time. But it really needs to be resolved, and changing this language to put it to a penalty up to makes it pretty clear that a judge and jury can determine what the exact penalty is and kind of weight the action of the developer when deciding what the penalty should be. So my basic interest is in that section of this thing, but you know, this whole act is up for revision, and it needs to be taken in its entirety at a later point. But for right now, we're satisfied to go with these few amendments. That's all I have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Spinelli. Any questions from the committee members? Thank you for your testimony. I think we'll hear from Mr. Faulkner. Are you available? John Faulkner, are you on the line? He was there, huh?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, there you are. Hello, John. How are you?
Very well. Can you hear me now?
We hear you fine. Please state your affiliation. Go ahead with your testimony.
Okay. My name is Jonathan Faulkner. I am the president of Lands End Development Corporation, which is developing and owns a high-end custom condominium project adjacent to Lands End Resort at the tip of Homer Spit. I appreciate your time today, and I'm going to testify primarily with regard to the substantially similar language as it relates to the POS as opposed to the penalty, but I'll testify to both. I first want to point out this is a clarification and not a substantive change at all, at least with regard to the POS. And the clarification is needed because the law is unclear, and this does not serve anybody's interests. The reason it's unclear is that you can give a public offering statement to a buyer in full compliance with the intent of the act, let's just say in July, and the 15-day clock starts to run. You can have the mutual intent to build a high-end custom condominium, proceed with construction, financing, construction, all the way through completion. And then you have to survey the building. And I want to go back at this point to Mr. Osterman's question about what is different between a condominium and a typical home. And one of the differences, we have to survey these things. We have to survey the box, the airspace that Representative Roeckberg was referring to. And we need that survey to go into the final recorded document that really defines the person's legal description. That, in turn, is used to determine their percentage of ownership of these common areas. So back to my original scenario where you this 15-day statutory requirement of this right of rescission, let's call it, starts to run in July. You build the building. You get to closing or get to the point of completion and you want to close, and you have to survey and finalize your declaration and update your public offering statement to reflect that finality or that final, say, square footage allocations that determine ownership. In a lot of cases, they're the same. It doesn't change, but the custom homes that change during construction can alter things. And the point I'm trying to make here is that the law is not clear that you can issue a POS in good faith and full compliance with what I believe is the intent, yet get to final completion, and a buyer could technically argue that this public offering statement is not the original public offering statement, and the 15-day clock starts at this point, i.e. after construction, and therefore they have a right of rescission when you have 100% as a developer, you have 100% invested. And so that is what is Representative Roepberg's Bill 470 does. It clarifies that if your original public offering statement is issued in good faith and is substantially the same as what is finally recorded, then you're in compliance with the law. And I think that serves the consumer's best interest. I think it serves general commerce best interest and the best interest of all parties. I'll say one other thing, and that is I really don't think that the framers of this law intended a buyer to be able to back out of a deal at the 11th and a half hour. And so I can't imagine that something that onerous was the original intent. Back when this law was framed, I believe condominium development was really confined for the most part to large, say, 50-unit plus buildings that were not as customized and certainly less expensive than what I'm doing. And so losing one deal, maybe at the 11th hour, wasn't as onerous to a developer or as damaging. But clearly, I'm building three at a time, and my bank is certainly aware of this loophole, and it has impacted my ability to get financing, and to the point where they're requiring unreasonable amounts of cash, in some cases 100%, to be set aside in escrow with absolutely ironclad language that restricts a buyer's ability to back out. So it is impeding commerce at this point, and I believe that it's a needed clarification and one that we deserve, because I can't imagine that the intent of this language was to allow a willing buyer and a willing seller to come to an agreement and then before custom construction, and then again at the 11th hour decide through some technicality, some minor revision that couldn't be avoided, that they have the right to back out. So that concludes my testimony. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions, committee members? I have a question, Mr. Faulkner. You stated that the bank is aware of this ability for the buyer to back out. Was it the bank that brought this to your attention, or how is this element?
This was brought to my attention from my attorney. She's one of the she's regarded as one of the most knowledgeable and specialized in this field of Common Ownership Act, the UKIA. Her name is Sandra Wicks. She does the lion's share of law, I believe, for the private sector and even some public sector work with regard to this UKIA legislation. And she was the one who pointed it out to me initially that the law is unclear. It's never been litigated, but the problem is that the probability, as low as it might be, times the risk of it happening is absolutely still disproportional, because it may happen once in a million years, but that one time it's going to happen, it's going to devastate the developer and bankrupt the person, because nobody can afford, at least a few people, I should say, can afford to build a, say, $1 million custom condominium and then have it go south on you in the last minute. Chances are that that's been customized and can't be resold at that price to
Thank you. And then just one follow-up question before. You mentioned it had never been, and maybe this is for the sponsor, it was never been litigated. Has there been any other individual that's been, that this has been imposed on him prior to your aware of?
There's no pending litigation. There's no pending issue with regard to my project that relates to this. There are no unhappy customers, disgruntled, buyers or sellers at this point. I'm simply, and I'm urging you to view this as a proactive measure that serves everybody's interest, facilitates commerce, and is a prudent precaution that needs to happen. So, no, to answer your question, I'm not aware of any past, present, future litigation or probability of that.
Okay. That answers my question. Thank you. Any other questions or comments from committee members? We got a motion to move the committee to move the bill from committee. Senator Lehman.
Mr. Chairman, I move to report House Bill 470 from committee with individual recommendations and the accompanying zero fiscal note.
Is there objection to moving House Bill 470 from committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Representative. Without objection, House Bill 470 is moved from committee with attached fiscal note of March 4th, 2002 to report to the Senate President for the next assignment. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, all of you, for being online. Next, we'll go to House Bill 306, Euthanasia for Domestic Animals, and I believe we have Representative Lancaster here as sponsor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Appreciate you hearing House Bill 306 today. In Alaska, the animal control agencies do not have the authority to purchase, possess, or use certain drugs to perform the most humane method of euthanasia for domestic animals. Right now, a veterinarian has to be called to perform this, or the animal would have to be taken to the veterinarian facility. If an animal is brought in suffering, nothing can be done until a veterinary gets there, and this could take hours, or if it has to be transported again to the veterinary's facility. If House Bill 306 were to pass, injured animals would not have to suffer these hours of suffering, and the process would be more humane. During business hours, the veterinarian may be busy with other animals, unable to respond immediately, or sometimes there would not be a veterinarian in town in small villages out in western Alaska. In larger communities, this is not uncommon, but again, in rural communities, it would be. These areas have access to a veterinarian only occasionally and have to resort to harsher methods of euthanasia. If an animal was brought in the middle of the night, it would take longer for a vet to respond. Pet owners would still have the option of bringing their animals to a vet for this service if they so chose. The goal of House Bill 306 is not to take business away from veterinarians, but to provide a more humane, cost-effective method to treat sick or abandoned animals. Not only would it be more efficient and humane, it will also save municipalities money. With the fiscal situation the state is in, finding areas to save money is essential. In the Mat-Su alone, the animal shelter is spending $34,000 and up per year to contract for this service with a local veterinarian. Fairbanks, a case is up to $85 per case. Even if the cost of fees, courses, and the drugs, these shelters will still save money. Agencies in this program will be under the Self-Sufficiency Act, so this will not cost the state of Alaska any money. Agencies wishing to apply will have certain guidelines to follow in order to obtain and keep these permits. Those who will be administering these drugs will have to complete a euthanasia technician certification course that is approved by the National Animal Control Association, the American Humane Association, or the Humane Society of the United States. During committee hearings in the House, there was concern that drugs would be available to untrained individuals. There will be no more of a chance than other places these drugs are stored at the present time. Any agency that applies for the permit will have the rules that are in effect for veterinarians, as they have to apply to the same rules. Also, agencies will be under the same regulations concerning any drugs that are in possession of the vets as well. But we have to keep under lock and key and license supervision. In contacts with the DEA, we found there have been very few investigations of these drugs, and those were due to improper storage. There are approximately 31 other states that have these laws allowing animal control agencies the right to apply for a permit to purchase, possess, and use drugs for euthanasia of domestic animals. I don't feel that many states would agree on this issue when it was causing problems. With that, I'll attempt to answer any questions, and I believe there are a couple of folks online that can speak more to the specific details of the bill.
Great. Thank you for your testimony. Do we have any questions or comments from committee members before we take public testimony? Hearing none, we have several people online. If you could please do your best to limit your testimony to the legislation at hand, we'd appreciate that. And with that said, we'll go to Valdez first, to Shanna Anderson. Are you available?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. If you state your name and your affiliation for the record, please go ahead with the testimony.
My name is Shanna Anderson, and I have been the Animal Control Officer of Valdez for almost 13 years. I am also the President of the Alaska Animal Control Association. I'd like to say that in support of this bill, I have all these years purchased any necessary drugs through a licensed veterinarian. I am very lucky in the fact that our local vet and I have a really good working relationship. That is not always the case. There are other agencies that have had problems being able to purchase drugs. Anybody in this field who performs euthanasia, are professional people. They're compassionate people. The act of euthanasia is a stressful and sad act. Compounding the fact that obtaining the drugs, which are actually tools that we need to perform the act of euthanasia, can add to all that stress. No shelter and no person that I know of in this profession I would like to be put out of business, quite frankly. We would all like to see the necessity of euthanasia to be a thing of the past. The way things are in the world, that is not so. 6 to 8 million animals in this country are euthanized, not because they are bad animals, injured animals, or sick animals, but due to the lack of homes. And until that issue is addressed and taken care of, euthanasia is a necessary act in animal shelters and humane societies across the state. It's just important for us to be able to obtain the tools, again, that we need to perform a humane act of euthanasia. That's pretty much all I have, and thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Anderson. Any questions from committee members? Thank you, Ms. Anderson. Next, we'll go to Fairbanks. Laura Hood, are you available?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Yes, go ahead, Ms. Hood. Please state your affiliation for the record and go ahead with testimony.
My name is Laura Hood. I'm the manager of the Fairbanks North Star Borough Division of Animal Control. I also would like to support this bill, HB 306. Unfortunately, thousands of animals are euthanized in shelters in the state of Alaska each year. This bill allows animal shelter workers to legally purchase, maintain, and use the drug, which is accepted as the most humane euthanasia method that we have available to us. This bill will save municipalities money as they become available to purchase these drugs, as they become able to purchase these drugs directly from the manufacturer. They will no longer have to rely on the services of a veterinarian to purchase or administer the drugs, which can cost municipalities thousands of dollars each year. It will protect veterinarians by removing the responsibility of these drugs when used in animal shelters from the veterinarian and placing it with the animal sheltering agencies. It will allow communities without veterinarians to practice modern, safe, and humane animal control. It will allow humane euthanasia of sick or injured pets in emergencies that may occur day or night. The euthanasia technician certification requirement will set a statewide standard for the level of care that pets receive in their last moments of life and will raise the level of professionalism in animal control workers providing this service. I'd really urge you to support this bill. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Hood, for your testimony. Do you have comments from committee members? Hearing none, thank you for your testimony. Next, we'll go to Kenai, to Brett Reed.
Yes, I'm Brett Reed with the City of Kenai Animal Control.
Thank you, Mr. Reed. Go ahead with testimony.
We urge you to support this bill to give us, like Laura was saying, the tools we need to conduct this operation. There's sometimes some misconceptions about the process. It is a more complicated process than just a shot. It is a controlled overdose, essentially, and it does require some training. At my last check, this course was offered 20 times in the coming year and probably will be offered in Juneau this year as well. Federal record keeping is pretty well established, so we don't really have to reinvent the wheel on that issue. And it's not really a blank ticket to buy drugs, only certain ones that are specifically listed in the bill, and we do urge you to support this one.
Thank you for your testimony. Any comments? Hearing none, we'll go to Ms. Clark. Are you in Kenai as well?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead with your testimony. Please state your affiliation for the record.
Thank you. My name is Mary Ann Clark. I'm with the city of Soldotna. I've been in the animal control field for over 25 years, and we do urge you to support this bill. Like the others have testified, this is a very important tool for us to use. It's the most humane method of euthanizing the animals. And I will be available if you do have any questions or any comments. I'll be glad to comment. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions from the committee members? Hearing none, we'll go to Sitka to Nancy Buckmaster.
Yes, this is Nancy Buckmaster. I'm the animal control officer here in Sitka. I run the shelter and I'm the euthanasia technician. I've been certified as a euthanasia technician for almost 4 years now, and have a good working relationship with the veterinarians, the two veterinarians that work here. I ask that you would support this bill, not only for communities that have access, but for those communities that don't have access to veterinarians, that the cost would be raised up for their euthanasia program. Right now, today, I have an animal in my shelter that attacked one of the family members and a family household dog. It came in yesterday. It needs to be euthanized. It's a vicious dog. One of the veterinarians is out on a herring opening, and the other is out of town. I'm unable to get the drugs I need to euthanize this dog, and it's important that you realize it's more of a timing thing for those of us that have good working relationships with our veterinarians. If I'm not able to get the drugs when I need them, the process has to wait. And if you understand anything about euthanasia, anybody who performs euthanasia usually has to be mentally ready. And when those tools are not available for us, we then again have to redo our mental state and get prepared again to euthanize an animal. It's not an easy process, but the timing has to be there. I would ask that you support this bill for not only us, but all the smaller communities and that are in the Alaska area.
Thank you for. Does that conclude your testimony?
Yes, sir, it does.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions from committee members? Hearing none, thank you for your testimony. We have a couple people here in Anchorage. Ms. Lee, Hava Lee. Would you like to come forward for your testimony, please?
This is Juneau, Mr. Chairman.
What did I say? Anchorage? Oh, I was thinking about home, I guess. Excuse me. Juneau.
Your true colors.
Huh?
And your family's here with you.
I know that my family's here with me. Sorry about that.
My name is Hava Lee, and I'm the executive director of the Juneau Gastineau Humane Society. And I urge you all to support this bill. Everyone who has testified today and who is involved in the animal welfare business knows that euthanasia is a difficult topic. It's difficult for people to listen to, and it's difficult for us that have to do this. But it is part of our job. And there is training and expertise that's involved in euthanizing an animal, and this is not a procedure to be taken lightly. but there is nothing in this bill that says that organizations would have to discontinue using a veterinarian for this service, and probably in Juneau we would continue. In fact, I suspect that many may continue this. What this bill does is it provides options that allows qualified individuals to have access to euthanasia drugs and to administer them. In instances where a veterinarian is not available, this could mean the difference between a humane death or hours or even days of endless agony for an animal. One thing I would like to make clear is that supporters of this bill, including humane societies and animal shelters and animal control officers throughout the state, do not see this bill as a cheap way to reduce our animal population. The Gastineau Humane Society, like most animal organizations, have an aggressive spay and neuter program. And humane societies and animal shelters do not create domestic animal overpopulations, but we are the individuals and organizations responsible for dealing with the problems of our pets when they populate too much. In Juneau, as in most, if not all, humane societies and animal shelters, animals are euthanized if there is no possibility they could be adopted. We do euthanize animals that are severely injured, old, and too sick to recover, and or vicious. And like most animal welfare organizations, we go out of our way to find homes for adoptable animals. But we do not have a list of people who want to adopt a 17-year-old cat that sprays and has diabetes. It's just the reality. It goes without saying that we could never find an insurance carrier that would cover a vicious animal that would then bite or even possibly kill a human being. Euthanasia is a humane procedure, and we would like to have the opportunity to provide that to the animals in our care. And again, I urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from committee members? Thank you for your testimony. I believe we have Ms. Reardon signed up. She's the last one on the list here. She walk out. She gone? Is she on the phone there? Here she is.
You're here for me?
Would you like to testify to the bill?
Sorry, I was just before the meeting.
Thank you for your patience. My name is Catherine Reardon, Director of the Division of Occupational Licensing in the Department of Community and Economic Development. And my division staffs the Veterinary Board. And I have reviewed and worked with the sponsor so that the bill would so we'd be able to administer the bill, the law, if it passes. And so I don't have any technical problems with the bill in terms of the division. The Veterinary Board is not entirely comfortable with the bill because they are concerned about whether there'll be sufficient insurance that the euthanasia drugs will be kept secure in community settings. They're not entirely comfortable that that there will be enough security or compliance with DEA requirements, and they're also concerned about pre-medication, as they refer to it, which is that sometimes animals need to be given a soothing drug before they can be euthanized, because perhaps they are agitated or more wild dogs kind of situation, and that in order to get the euthanasia drug into them, you need to give them a shot of a tranquilizer kind of thing. And at the same time, they think that's important for humane euthanasia. They're a bit concerned about those drugs having potentials to be street drugs. So I want to share that view from the board's perspective, and also to say that since the division would be directly administering the bill, not the board, I think it works for us administratively. I'm assuming that DEA finds that this bill meets its requirements to indeed release the drugs to the communities.
Thank you. Any questions, committee members?
I have one question.
Senator Davis?
Could you say if the the veterinarian that had this concern, did they bring it up on the outside? Was it addressed over there?
I believe it was mentioned in House Labor and Commerce.
Senator Osterman?
Kathy, the concern by the board on the control of the drugs being not going to be tight enough, is that my basic understanding of what you're saying?
Yes, to the chair, yes.
Right now, those drugs are controlled by the veterinarians themselves, so there's not a problem. Is that my understanding?
Through the chair, yes, DEA has rules about tracking the drugs and locking them up and things like that. And the veterinarians' DEA permits are on the line if they don't adhere with those adhere to those regulations.
And I assume then, with the new rules of this bill, that the municipalities or whoever's going to be doing it would fall under those same rules, though, I mean, as far as controlling and taking care of the drugs.
Through the chair, yes. I think the concern comes when it gets to smaller communities who may not have the resources or the staff to successfully adhere with all of the DEA requirements.
Assuming that they're fall that but they fall under the same rules.
It'll be different rules.
They would
yes,
fall under the same rules.
That's my understanding.
If they're not, I mean, if there's a violation of the rule, there's a violation of the rule.
Yes.
Regardless of the size of the community.
Yes.
Ready for a motion?
I'll accept the motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 306 out of committee with individual recommendations accompanying fiscal note.
Is there objection to the motion to move House Bill 306 to the next referral, which would be the Senate President for further referral to the rules? Without objection, House Bill 306 moves from committee with attached fiscal note of 211-2002. Thank you, Representative Lancaster. Next, we'll move to House Bill 389, Municipal Tax Exemption for Deteriorated Property, and I believe we have Representative Coring here.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and the members of the Labor and Commerce Committee. I appreciate your indulgence and for hearing my House Bill 389 here. I'm Vic Coring. I represent Wausau and Chugiak in the legislature. House Bill 389 is an amendment to Title 29 that would allow for certain types of property exemptions that would enable deteriorated properties that are subject to rehabilitation to have greater odds in terms of financing of those properties. And as you probably remember, there's a building in Anchorage, the McKay building, the infamous McKay building that has been an eyesore for many years, that has been purchased by Marlow Development Corporation, and they're attempting to upgrade that building. However, the building needs to obtain additional financing, and this legislation would enable them, as well as other properties that are in a deteriorated state, to obtain that financing, because if they have a tax exemption, essentially it puts them in a better financial position to be able to get the dollars that they need from investors or banking institutions. So what we're basically doing here is adding to the law an additional item here as far as potential properties that would be permitted to be granted a tax exemption. Currently under the law, there's in that category are historical sites, nonprofit organization property, student housing, among others, and this would add properties that require substantial rehabilitation, deteriorated properties. As some of you might recollect, back in 96-97, there was a bill that was passed that addressed the same issue. However, that bill is about ready to come, that law is about ready to come to an end, because there was a sunset provision put in that bill of July 1st, 2002, and of course that's less than just 3 months away. So instead of extending the sunset, what this legislation does, it just simply deletes that sunset clause. I do have with me my aide, Mike Krieber, who's worked on this legislation. He's here to help answer any questions. And I also have Mr. Mark Marlowe behind me here, whose property I referred to earlier, who would be happy to answer any questions as well. So with that, I sure appreciate your consideration of this legislation, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Lehman?
Chairman, I understand the reason for the legislation. In fact, I worked on it. I think I chaired the Labor and Commerce Committee when we did the work on this. But my question is, why didn't you just extend the sunset date into some time certain rather than remove it? It seems to me that, you know, the reason we did it originally was we wanted some action, and some action, like you mentioned, the McKinley Building, which should be called that.
Right.
You know, we wanted action sooner rather than later, and this actually helped inspire some action on that. Wouldn't it make more sense to just extend it sometime than let a future legislature deal with it, than to just take the sunset out?
Right. Well, actually, my original legislation here did have a time certain in there, and I believe it was 5 years. Was it 2005? So it extended it 4 years. The House Committee of Regional Affairs Committee amended the legislation, and they felt that it was better to just completely drop that exemption. And Mike, would you please further address that to explain why that committee took that action?
Somebody else.
Oh, no, I just hear him say the same thing over again.
For the record, my name is Mike Krieber. I'm an aide for Representative Coring. Mr. Chairman, committee members, the Community Regional Affairs Committee in the House looked at this particular issue a few years ago. This bill came through their committee also. When the bill left the committee the first time a few years ago, there was no sunset provision on the House side. The sunset provision was added on the Senate side. One of the sponsors of the follow-up legislation, Representative Halcrow, had placed in language on the second year some provisions relating to local community control and local community decisions that he felt were adequate controls so that there would not be abuse of the legislation for any certain individuals in the community to gain unfair economic benefit. That was the rationale that the committee used to remove the sunset extension that Representative Coring's original bill had proposed and replace it with the no sunset provision.
Further comments? Senator Osterman?
I'm trying to understand a little bit more about ASA 295405, when it actually exempts. What period? I mean, this, it talks about a deteriorated building being exempt, and once renovation started, and does that exemption then go away after renovation is completed?
What the legislation originally? My name is Mark Marlowe, for the record. Greetings.
Affiliation, Mr. Marlowe.
Representing myself as Marlowe Development Corporation.
Thank you.
The legislation that was originally passed in the session that was mentioned previously, the goal was to develop a way for local communities to extend property tax relief to deteriorated property for up to 5 years of an outright exemption, and up followed by up to 5 years of deferred taxes property taxes, with the idea that as you take a deteriorated property and decide what kind of a subsidy you need to make it all work, that it could be exempted for a year or two or five and have no deferral, or exempted and deferred for the entire 10 years that the statute allows for, depending on, you know, what renovations or the extent of rehabilitation the property needed. And so what has to happen by statute is that the local assembly must first, by ordinance, designate a property that would endeavor to benefit from this statute as a deteriorated property. And once that is designation is placed on the property by ordinance, then the developer can come in to the CFO of the municipality and request the up to 5 years of exemption and up to five, followed by up to 5 years of deferral based upon what the need is. And then once that request is made to the CFO, then the mayor and the assembly then would approve it or change it or reject it. So it's based on, there's a sort of a graduation there of what you need based on the work you have to do.
Any comment?
Senator Dorsey. I agree with Senator Lehman. We should have went to a date certain. But the title's so tight now, I'd take a title change to do it.
Any comment? Any further comment or debate? What's the will of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 389 out of the committee with individual recommendation and attach this note, which I don't see. I don't know what it is.
Zero.
Oh, there it is, zero.
Is there objection to moving House Bill 389 from committee on to its next committee referral? The Finance Committee? Without objection, House Bill 389 is moved from committee with attached fiscal note of 225.02/0. And with that, thank you for your testimony.
Chairman,
I'm sorry, Mr. Marley, did you want to testify? Excuse me, I'm sorry.
No, I'm fine.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for your support of the legislation. Appreciate it.
Thank you. For the committee's information, we have no meeting on Thursday, April 4th. Well, that would stand adjourned at 2:50, excuse me. And we are wearing Juno, not Anchorage.